Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Okay, we are studying now the Anapanasati Sutta. This is Sutta number 118 in the Majjhima Nikaya. Now, in paragraph 15 of the sutta, before the Buddha gives the 16 step or 16 aspect analysis of mindfulness of breathing, he makes a statement: when mindfulness of breathing is developed and cultivated, it fulfills the four foundations of mindfulness. When the four foundations of mindfulness are developed and cultivated, they fulfill the seven enlightenment factors. When the seven enlightenment factors are developed and cultivated, they fulfill true knowledge and deliverance, or higher knowledge and liberation. Okay, so now, last time we finished explaining the 16 steps, or the 16 aspects of mindfulness of breathing. And now we come to the section where the Buddha is going to show how the 16 steps, or he's going to show how mindfulness of breathing fulfills the four foundations of mindfulness. And he does this by incorporating these 16 steps, 16 aspects of mindfulness of breathing into the four foundations of mindfulness. He actually will divide the 16 steps into four divisions, and then these four divisions will He will correlate with the four foundations of mindfulness. And this is what he is going to explain in this section of the sutta, beginning on paragraph 23. So he raises the question, how does mindfulness of breathing, when developed and cultivated, fulfill the four foundations of mindfulness? And then he repeats, we call these groups of four, we use the expression tetrad, which is almost like quartet. It means a group of four. So he repeats the first four stages, four aspects of mindfulness of breathing. And these are the four aspects in the Satipatthana Sutta, the discourse on the foundations of mindfulness. These are the four aspects that come as the first section in Kayanupassana, contemplation of the body. And so he says, whenever a monk breathing in long knows I breathe in long, when breathing out long, he knows I breathe out long. Breathing in short, he understands I breathe in short. When breathing out short, he understands I breathe out short. When he experiences when he breathes in, experiencing the whole body of breath. When he trains thus, I shall breathe out, experiencing the whole body of breath. When he trains thus, I shall breathe in, tranquilizing the bodily formation. When he trains thus, I shall breathe out, tranquilizing the bodily formation. Okay, that is a repetition of that first tetrad. On that occasion, a monk abides contemplating the body as a body, ardent, fully aware, or I would now use clearly comprehending and mindful, having put away covetousness, longing, and grief for the world. Have we come across this expression before? Contemplating the body as a body, ardent, fully aware and mindful, having put away covetousness and grief for the world. Have we seen it before? Where did we see it? In the Satipatthana Sutta. Hey, you're not supposed to answer. I'm asking the students who are here regularly. This is part of what we call the refrain, the repeating section in the Satipatthana Sutta. Again and again, we come across this passage. Okay, so this means that when one is breathing in, breathing out mindfully, observing the breath as it comes in, as it goes out, whether it's long or short, one is contemplating the body. When one is experiencing, when one is breathing in, breathing out, experiencing the whole body, whether that is understood as experiencing the entire body from the head to the tips of the toes, or experiencing the entire course of the in-breath and out-breath, as explained in the commentaries, through the three stages of beginning to breathe in, the entire course of the in-breath, to the very moment of the end of the in-breath, then the very beginning of the out-breath, the whole course of the out-breath, to the very moment of stopping the out-breath. One could interpret it either way, but in either way, it's clearly it's an observation of the body, of some physical process, and then breathing in, breathing out, tranquilizing the bodily formation. The body formation is the in and out breathing. Tranquilizing it, one is bringing a bodily process, making a bodily process calm down, settle down. So that is a contemplation of the body. Okay, and here the Buddha makes the statement why he includes this observation of the breathing in contemplation of the body. I'd like to take that in the Pali first. Kayesu kai anyataraham bhikave etang vadami yadidang asasa pasasam. Among bodies, O monks, I call this a particular body. That is to say, in-breathing and out-breathing. So, the word for body, kaya, is used conventionally to designate various things in the Indian way of speaking. The most common is to speak about this physical body, but in India in that time they sometimes spoke about everything solid and material as the earth body. Or we have the expression in English, a body of water. That's a body. We don't call that a physical body. They had even the expression, a big mass of fire is called, I think it's called Agikaya, a fire body. a strong wind is called a wind body. So we use the body, they use the word body in different senses. And amongst different types of bodies, this is one type of body, in breathing and out breathing. And of course, in breathing and out breathing, it's a bodily, clearly it's a bodily process. It's not just a convention of speech, but it's a physical process. And so for this reason, the observation of in and out breathing is a form of bodily contemplation. And so for this reason, the Buddha says, this is why on that occasion, that is when the monk is observing the breath, going in, going out, and so on, he abides contemplating the body as a body, or more literally, contemplating the body in the body, ardent, clearly comprehending and mindful, having put away covetousness or craving, strong desire, and grief or dejection towards the world. Okay, now in the Satipatthana Sutta, Anapanasati, mindfulness of breathing, as one of the exercises, stops with contemplation of the body. It's one of the exercises in contemplation of the body. But now we're going to see how mindfulness of the breathing extends into the other three foundations of mindfulness. We come to paragraph 25. On whatever occasion a monk trains thus, I shall breathe in experiencing rapture. This is now the second tetrad, second group of four. On whatever occasion a monk trains thus, I shall breathe in experiencing rapture. Trains thus, I shall breathe out experiencing rapture. Trains thus, I shall breathe in experiencing pleasure, sukha, pleasant feeling, or blissful feeling. Trains thus, I shall breathe out experiencing pleasure, or pleasant feeling, blissful feeling. Trains thus, I shall breathe in experiencing the mental formation, citta sankhara. Trains thus, I shall breathe out experiencing the mental formation. And what is the mental formation? Right. Trains thus, I shall breathe in tranquilizing the mental formation, making it more calm, more peaceful. Trains thus, I shall breathe out tranquilizing the mental formation. On that occasion, a monk abides, contemplating feelings as feelings, ardent, fully aware or clearly comprehending and mindful, having put away covetousness or longing and grief or dejection for the world. Okay, so this set of four is now incorporated within the contemplation of feelings. But here, this is a passage which has to be interpreted in certain ways. Otherwise, it could lead to some misinterpretation. We come back to the first pair. I shall breathe in experiencing rapture. I shall breathe out experiencing rapture. The word for rapture, the Pali word, is piti. Okay, now rapture itself is not a feeling. Though I've seen even senior monks pick upon this passage and then argue because rapture is mentioned here and this is said to be contemplating feelings as feelings, therefore rapture is a feeling. But in fact, piti is not included amongst the feelings. What are the feelings? Vedana.
Just a positive, negative, and neutral. Positive, negative, and neutral.
Usually we don't say positive, negative.
Pleasant, unpleasant.
Usually we don't say simply unpleasant, we say pleasant. Yeah, pleasant feeling, painful feeling, neutral feeling. Sometimes we expand feelings into five types. I don't know if I've discussed this previously. We take the pleasant feeling and divide it into two types, depending upon whether it is purely physical, in which case it's called pleasant, sukha, then the mental feeling is called, translated sometimes as joy, but it's not piti, it's somanasa. So in the realm of feelings, we have first the pleasant, we have a threefold division of feelings into the pleasant, painful, and neutral. But then the texts give a finer division of feelings into five types. They take the pleasant feeling and they distinguish that as either mental or physical pleasant feeling. When one makes this distinction, then the mental pleasant feeling is called somanasa, which we can translate as joy. And the physical pleasant feeling is sukha, which means pleasure.
You said that the text makes the division. Are you talking the commentaries or is this?
No, this is from the canonical text. Oh. Yeah, especially in some Vedana Samyutta and Samyutta Nikaya, or actually Indriya Samyutta, Samyutta Nikaya. So one has to be careful. You see, the word sukha, pleasant feeling, is used in a broad sense and a narrow sense. Then painful feeling also has the broad sense and or the comprehensive sense in which all painful feeling comes into painful feeling. But then painful feeling is divided into the mental and the physical. The mental feeling, mental painful feeling, is called domanasa, which here I give a translation, dejection, which no translation is really satisfactory. You might say, because dejection is usually a very grave sense. This is what is often translated grief, but I think that's too, it is too strong. It's any kind of unhappiness, even a slight degree of discontent, dissatisfaction, little sadness, sorrow, all of that is domanasa. And then there's physical pain, which is dukkha in the very narrow sense, like when you scrape your hand or touch a burning hot surface and feel pain. You get pain in your legs, feel ill. Then the neutral feeling, which is called adukkama sukha vedana, not pain, not pleasant feeling. It's not divided into physical and mental. Though actually it seems to me one can make that distinction. It would seem that there are physical experiences or sensory experiences which are neutral, and also states of mind which are neutral. But for some reason the texts don't draw a distinction between them. They just group them all together and speak simply of this neutral feeling and call this, when they have the fivefold scheme, then they call it upeka vedana. And you have to be careful not to confuse upeka. Upeka means equanimity or equanimous feeling, but one has to be careful not to confuse upeka vedana, equanimity as a feeling of neither pleasant nor pain, with equanimity as, you might say, the mental state of the state of mental composure. You've already confused it. Yep. Upeka, as you might call one of the spiritually desirable states, is mental composure, not being knocked off course by gain and loss, praise and blame, fame and dishonor and so on, pleasure and pain, gain and loss. But equanimity, what's called equanimous feeling, is just the feeling of not pleasant, not painful. But generally, when the mind is in a state of composure, that's spiritual equanimity, it will tend to be accompanied by equanimous feeling. But there's also a kind of worldly equanimous feeling that goes with, we call it dull indifference. Like somebody who just maybe just drifts along in life.
But the word's the same.
Strangely, the word is the same.
So you have to really know the nuances when reading the Pali.
That is so, yeah. Look at, I won't take it now, but if you just want to see these, the way the terms are used, let's see what it is, 138 or 136. Sutta number 137. I'm not going to go into it now. We didn't do this sutta. I'll have to add it to the syllabus. Take it at a later time. It's very interesting. But now we want to go back to our Anapanasati Sutta. Okay, so the point I wanted to make, this is a little detour, is that piti, rapture, sometimes I explain it as joy, but not so manasa. Rapture, elation, exhilaration, is not itself a feeling, but it's closely associated with sukha, with pleasant feeling. And so when one is experiencing rapture, always there is pleasant feeling going right alongside of it. So for this reason, I think this is a reason that it has been included in this section on contemplation of feeling. And so in the first stage of contemplation of feelings, one is contemplating rapture and pleasure running alongside each other or going hand in hand together. But rapture is now more prominent because I think I used the simile last week. It's like in a jazz band, rapture is like the saxophone player. Pleasure is like the piano player. And so as long as the saxophone player is playing, one doesn't hear the piano. Or it doesn't really stand out. The piano is not prominent. It's just there providing melody, providing rhythm. But everybody is admiring the saxophonist. But it's only when the saxophonist finishes his solo, goes into the background, the piano takes over, and now one really hears and admires the skill of the piano player. That is when rapture fades out, and now pleasure or bliss becomes prominent. And that is the second aspect of contemplation of in this tetrad. And it's pleasure or bliss that is the feeling aspect. Okay, and so one breathes in experiencing pleasure, one breathes out experiencing pleasure. Then the third tetrad, now it seems, I would say that there is a shift in focus now. One is still experiencing feeling, it can be pleasure, but it can also be equanimity. But whatever feeling one is experiencing, one is considering the feeling simply as mental formation, as some factor associated with the mind. and so on, is now breathing in, breathing out, experiencing the mental formation. The mental formation, according to the text, what is the mental formation? I already asked that. It's feeling and perception. Sanya cha vedana cha. That is the mental formation. And so one is now experiencing the mental formation, one is experiencing feelings, experiencing perceptions also, I would think. But I would say, since this is contemplation of feeling, probably the feelings are more prominent. What I think would be taking place is that now, it could be that the mental formation is mentioned because now this is to include any feeling that arises, including the neutral or equanimous feeling. And it could be that now, instead of focusing upon the quality of the feeling, as whether it be pleasure, painful, or neutral, one is now simply focusing upon that feeling as a feeling. That would be equivalent to the stage in the Satipatthana Sutta, where one comes to the point where he observes Ati Vedanati Sati Pachupatita Hoti Yavadeva Jnana Mataya Patisati Mataya. There are feelings, that is, his mindfulness is set up only for the sake of knowledge, only for the sake of continuous knowledge, for continuous mindfulness. And so now one is observing, while breathing in and out, whatever feeling arises, simply as feeling, without special concern for its qualitative tone, whether pleasant, painful, or neutral. And then as one breathes in and out with the mindfulness increasing, the feeling becomes more and more peaceful, the breath becomes more and more peaceful, and the feeling also becomes more and more peaceful. So one is breathing in, breathing out, tranquilizing the mental formation. So in this way, the monk dwells contemplating feelings as feelings, ardent, clearly comprehending, and mindful. Okay, now the Buddha makes a statement that's a little bit strange. Well, let's say the text makes a statement that's a little bit strange. Vedanasu vedanan vedanan yattaraham bhikave etam vadami yadidam asasa pasasanam sadukam manasi karam. I say that this is that among the feelings, this is a certain feeling, namely giving close attention to in breathing and out breathing. So here the Buddha or the text is saying that close attention, this is something called manasikara. Manasikara would be so wei in Chinese. So way. So way.
So all of just one character.
Just so.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Should I take this down? Zohi, would that be a modern Zohi, the modern translation? For Manasikara? No? Work in the mind? Okay, doesn't matter. Okay, now manasikara, which means attention, sadhuka means close, careful attention, is not a feeling, but it's another mental function. In fact, there is sometimes we have a list of mental functions, the basic mental functions. What it is, these basic mental functions? These are what make up nama, name or mentality, contact, feeling, perception, volition, and attention. So attention and feeling, two different factors. I think the reason for this, the commentary gives some explanation, I have to say. I can't really quite understand the commentary's explanation. It seems that it's not very clear to me, the explanation of the commentary. But basically what I would say is that, actually the commentary does make a good point. It says that sometimes one mental function is spoken of under a name suitable for another mental function. Like we have the expression in Pali, anicca sanya, which is literally, it means perception of impermanence. Now, what is perception of impermanence? Sanya. It's not actually the mental function of sanya, perception, but it is a kind of panya, the function of wisdom, of insight. But just the name sanya is used because there's a certain similarity. This is a wisdom that is a kind of direct visual type of experience. So we call it a perception. And so in this case, the attention being given very closely to, is being given very closely to the feelings. And so the attention almost picks up the quality of the feelings. And so that attention is being called or spoken of under the name feeling. That is basically the explanation in the commentary. Anybody have any ideas about this? Anyway, just think about it. Yeah.
I guess people do that in poetry all the time, right? And they say like it's a soft thought or something like that. And you can't really have a soft thought. A thought is a thought. There's nothing particularly soft or about it. But they use that word to bring other meaning into the
word,
even though it doesn't really make sense in the language, literally.
The personification. Right. That's not a personification. There's another expression for that.
Another bit of words, but I think that's kind of what's going on here. Does that make sense?
Perhaps. Yeah. A kind of transference of the qualities from one thing to another. a metaphor, you call it a metaphorical use. Okay, and let's come to the third tetrad now in paragraph 26. Okay, now we have the set of four that begins when breathing in, experiencing the mind, breathing out, experiencing the mind. When breathes in, gladdening the mind. That is, as one is doing the mindfulness of breathing in and out, this gladness or joy starts to arise in the mind. But now here, this joy is the beginning of piti, of rapture. But now the emphasis here is not on the rapture itself, but on the mind which is being infused with the rapture. Trying to think of an analogy, it's a little bit like if one were preparing some dish. One might have a bowl of some, preparing a cake. One has various ingredients in, and one is pouring milk into this batter. We call it the batter. Okay. In contemplation of rapture, a contemplation of the feelings, the focus will be on the milk being poured into the rapture. The focus is on the milk that's being poured into the batter. And so that is the focus point. In contemplation of the mind, when it's being, when it is gladdening the mind, the focus is on, analogously, it's on the batter into which the milk is entering. Okay, then one breathes in, breathes out, concentrating the mind, bringing the mind to a state of samadhi. Then one breathes in, breathes out, liberating the mind. And following the commentary, this doesn't mean, or probably doesn't mean, the final liberation of the mind, since we've not yet entered the stage of insight, but this is releasing the mind from the hindrances, releasing the mind from the different barriers that one will meet as one goes deeper and deeper into the meditation. Okay, and then the Buddha is now going to incorporate these four aspects, this tetrad, into chit anupassana, contemplation of the mind. So he says on that occasion, when the monk is practicing in that way, he abides contemplating mind as mind, ardent, fully aware, and mindful, having put away covetousness and grief for the world. And now he's going to explain why this section should be incorporated into contemplation of the mind. He says, I do not say that there is the development of mindfulness of breathing for one who is forgetful, who is not fully aware. Now, the word translated as forgetful here is in Pali mutta sati. And mutta has the sense of sort of being lost, and sati is, of course, mindfulness. And so mutta sati means lost mindfulness, confused or blurry mindfulness. We might say absent-mindedness. And so there cannot be development of mindfulness of breathing if the mindfulness is lost. And also, for there to be the development of mindfulness of breathing, one has to know the in when breathing in, that one is breathing in. One has to know when breathing out that one is breathing out. And so that knowing of breathing in and breathing out is the function of sampajanya, of clear comprehension or full awareness. And so it is mindfulness and clear comprehension already present from the very beginning of mindfulness of breathing. Those are the two factors that bring mindfulness of breathing to success. Not forcefully pushing the mind onto the breath, but being mindful of the breath. That is, keeping the breath present in the attention and clearly comprehending or knowing when breathing in that one is breathing in, when breathing out that one is breathing out. And this mindfulness and clear comprehension are functions of mind, of citta. And so the commentary here makes an interesting point. It says, let alone, it doesn't matter what one is practicing, what stage of mindfulness of breathing one is practicing. Not only when one is practicing breathing in, experiencing the mind, breathing out, experiencing the mind, but even when one is just being mindful of breathing in, breathing out, short, breathing in, breathing in, breathing out long, breathing in, breathing out short. The very first stages also, in a sense, can be seen as coming in the scope of contemplation of mind. Because to develop mindfulness of breathing, even at those stages, one needs mindfulness and one needs clear comprehension. Okay, so because one needs mindfulness and clear comprehension to practice or to develop mindfulness of breathing, the Buddha says that this is why on that occasion, when especially when developing these stages of experiencing the mind and so on, a monk abides contemplating mind as mind, ardent, fully aware and mindful, having put away covetousness and grief for the world. Okay, let me finish the last section, then we'll have questions and discussion. Okay, now we come to the fourth tetrad. And if you remember, last week I said that whereas the first three tetrads are primarily concerned with serenity or concentration, samadhi meditation, though they also involve insight as well, the last tetrad is concerned entirely with insight, with vipassana. And so here the monk is training, breathing out, breathing in, breathing out, contemplating impermanence, contemplating the fading away or dissolution of sankharas, formations, contemplating cessation of formations, contemplating the relinquishment, the giving up of formations. Okay, on that occasion, a monk abides contemplating, here I don't like mind objects as mind objects, but contemplating phenomena as phenomena, dhammesu dhammanupassi viharati. He dwells contemplating phenomena in phenomena, ardent, fully aware, clearly comprehending and mindful, having put away covetousness and grief for the world. Now the next sentence is very interesting. Let me just get it in the Pali. And I just have to say, after years, I just realized the significance of it this afternoon. So, yang tang abhija domana sanang pahanang tang panyaya disva sadhu kang aju pekita hoti. Having seen with wisdom, now I would say that which is the abandoning of covetousness and grief or longing and dejection, he closely looks on with equanimity. That is why on that occasion a monk abides contemplating phenomena as phenomena, ardent, fully aware and mindful, having put away covetousness and grief for the world. Okay, now the question, the problem is, what is the sentence, having seen with wisdom that which is the abandoning of covetousness and grief, he closely looks on with equanimity, how does that tie this in to contemplating phenomena as phenomena? And how does all of this tie up with contemplating impermanence, cessation, relinquishment, and so on? Now, this is the way I would understand it. Okay, in the Satipatthana Sutta, if you remember, in the section on contemplation of phenomena, Dhammanupassana, we have, I think there are five sections. The first section is contemplation of the five hindrances. The last section, well, actually, the last section is on the Four Noble Truths, but the next to the last section is on the seven factors of enlightenment. The first two of the five hindrances are sensual desire and ill will, kamachanda and vyapada. Now, sensual desire and ill will are sometimes spoken of as by these synonyms, covetousness and grief. So when covetousness and grief spoken of here, we have this reference to the beginning of the section of the five hindrances. Okay, so this is the beginning of the section on contemplation of phenomena. The section on the five hindrances. By mentioning covetousness and grief, abhijja domanassa, he's referring sort of indirectly to, or by way of synonyms, to sensual desire and ill will, the first and strongest of the five hindrances. And so all the five hindrances are included. And then the section on the five hindrances comes to its climax when one understands how the hindrances cease without, or abandoned without further arising. So that is what one has to achieve, is the abandoning without further arising of the hindrances. And that seems to be the implication of this abandoning of covetousness and grief. And that abandoning of the hindrances comes through wisdom. The wisdom which sees into the impermanence, the fading away, the cessation of formations, conditioned things, and culminates in this relinquishment of formations. Okay, then the next to last section in the section on the contemplation of phenomena is a section on the seven factors of enlightenment. And the last of the seven factors of enlightenment is, what is the last of the seven factors of enlightenment? Say it again.
Equanimity.
In Pali, that is upekkha, right? Okay, and here we have, he closely looks on with equanimity. That's actually a rendering of sadhukam. What's rendered, he looks on with equanimity, is in the Pali ajupekita. Yeah, the what's called the first part, ajja, that's really just, it's a prefix. The real core of the word is upekkha. So looking on with equanimity seems to show the culmination and the development of the seven factors of enlightenment.
But to drop the hindrances entirely, it would stand to reason that the enlightenment path would be elevated and in balance, right?
Would be elevated.
And I guess in balance.
Yeah, yeah.
Otherwise you couldn't drop the hindrances.
Yeah, yeah. So that's why he closely looks on with wisdom, having seen with wisdom the abandoning of covetousness and grief. He closely looks on with equanimity. I don't know that this implies that he's actually reached the complete cutting off, the final eradication of the five hindrances. It could be that just within this, say, meditative session, through wisdom, he's brought the covetousness and grief to a state of subsiding. It could be that. I'm not quite sure how to understand it. Of course, it seems that he's still within training here, that he's not yet reached final liberation. That's the way I would see it in that book. But in any case, it's through developing these contemplations based upon the in and out breathing, one develops the contemplations of impermanence, fading away, cessation, relinquishment. In that way, these are contemplations with wisdom. One abandons, even if it's not yet eradication, but one abandons, at least temporarily, the five hindrances, and one reaches a state of mind where one is able to look on at the mental process with equanimity. So one has now reached a high level in the development of wisdom. And this is, thus it's a kind of contemplation of phenomena. Okay, and so this is how, in paragraph 28, mindfulness of breathing developed and cultivated fulfills the four foundations of mindfulness. Okay, I ask if there's any questions, any comments. Please feel welcome. Peter.
Sorry, I may have just said it, I have just missed it. So the reason why this abandoning of the hindrances is linked with the mind objects is because of these, it's via these insights that the hindrances are abandoned or suppressed?
Yeah, I would say first, these contemplations themselves are contemplations into phenomena. One is now contemplating impermanence, fading away, cessation of sankharas, of conditioned phenomena, of dhammas. And also, what takes place through this contemplation of phenomena is the overcoming of the five hindrances and the development of the seven enlightenment factors up to the point of equanimity. And the section on the five hindrances, the seven enlightenment factors, come within the scope of the contemplation of phenomena, contemplation of mind objects, in the scheme of the four foundations of mindfulness.
Because they are, those are mind objects.
Those are, yeah.
Gotcha.
But I don't really like mind objects. I think it's a mistaken translation. Yeah.
I'm not sure I understand why you think that when they state covetousness and greed, just the first two of the five, that implies all the others.
Yeah, this is... what I would call a kind of method that one finds in the suttas. Sometimes the text will refer to certain members of a group of categories, and from there one could understand that the others are implied. Anyway, this is my interpretation of it. And we do find that covetousness, in the explanation of the first hindrance, sensual desire, covetousness is sometimes used as a synonym for it. One doesn't find dominasa, what's translated grief here, explicitly used as an alternative for ill will. But the commentary explains it that way, and I tend to go along with it on that. And it seems to make good sense to see these two, even though strictly dominasa doesn't signify so much like anger, ill will directed towards a person, but rather a sad frame of mind. But both ill will and dejection or grief are both sort of negative states of mind, dark states of mind. Whereas covetousness, longing, desire is, we might call, a passionate or inflamed state of mind.
And you said that in other suttas that they use the mention to imply the rest, or mention food to imply the rest.
Well, this is the way the commentary sometimes interpret it, and I would go along with them in that.
I think I'm only confused because of the propensity for a listing in all the other suttas to include everything, to go from A to B to C.
You mean to include long lists?
Yes. And so to not have a list seems weird to me, but I understand what the implication is, and I'm willing to go along with it. That's why I was confused.
Anyway, I just take it as sort of implying the five hindrances. It doesn't have to take it to be stating them explicitly.
Okay.
But I say, this is my interpretation. Don't take it as gospel truth.
Bhante?
Yeah.
When the text says that he closely looks on the abandoning.
Yeah.
So at that stage, he already overcoming the hindrances?
At this stage, he would have overcome the hindrances.
So maybe looks on with equanimity is the factor that helped him move forward and avoid the impediments of vipassana.
And?
Avoid the impediments of vipassana. You know, like people take delight in the
impediments of vipassana.
Is that possible? Because with equanimity, you move on and you don't.
Yeah, let us see. It's possible, but I don't think the text is bringing in here what are called the impediments of vipassana. Though also, yeah, one could see that covetousness and grief for the world could extend not only to ordinary sort of lower grades of attachment and grief, but also to attachment to these experiences that arise in the course of vipassana, and grief when they don't fulfill one's expectations. But these are not explicitly really mentioned in the text. Dr. Murray?
I'd like to share a certain anguish. Ignorance is the attachment of the mind to the objects of experience. The identification is the object of experience. I have hoped that mindfulness of breathing would help me break that identification. Now, I learned in section 26 that there is no mindfulness of breathing for one who is not fully aware. And fully aware means aware of the mind as other than the object. In other words, the mind that is not identified with the object. So in order to achieve it, I have to have it. And I feel hopeless.
I didn't quite catch the.
It seems from section 26, in order for me to use mindfulness of breathing,
yeah,
to break the identification with phenomena, I must already have broken the identification by having this awareness of the mind as otherness.
No. I see. here by sampajanya doesn't mean that one is already the understanding. Is that what the point?
This is already have broken that identification.
No. Here by sampajanya would mean the full awareness or clear comprehension. Simply when breathing in, that one is breathing in. When breathing out, that one is breathing out. It doesn't mean that one, in order to begin mindfulness of breathing, one has to have overcome the identification with the object.
Well, if you have muscles, you have overcome it if you have clear comprehension?
No, not yet, no. One begins still within ignorance. One can't begin already with the wisdom of enlightenment. One has to begin within ignorance. Of course, one will, in order to carry the meditation through to the end, one should have what we call a conceptual right view, right understanding of the Dhamma. That's why we also emphasize listening to the teaching, studying the teaching, reflecting on the teaching, to understand what one has to achieve through insight, but without becoming too much attached to conceptual schemes. But the clear comprehension that is used for the practice of the meditation is simply in this initial stage being aware of the object. It is the clear comprehension in each aspect of the, in each phase of the process of in and out breathing, that one is engaged with that particular phase. And it is through that clear comprehension of the particular stage or phase that the mind is brought to a state of concentration, samadhi. And that it is through when the mind becomes concentrated that one can then focus very precisely, very closely upon what is occurring in one's moment-to-moment experience. And it is through the observation of what is taking place moment by moment that insight will arise, and it is that insight that brings the experiential wisdom. Okay, I think we'll have to stop now. It's getting late. Okay, we'll stop the end with the sharing of the merits. Okay, we share the merits with all the devas, buddhas, and other beings. Akasata cha bhumata Devanaga Mahidika Punyantang Anumodiva Chirang Rakantu Sasanang Akasata Chabumata Devanaga Mahidika Punyantang Anumodiva Chirang Rakantu Desanam Akasata Chabumata Devanaga Mahidika Punyantang Anumodiva Chirang Rakantu Mangparang Etavata chamhehi sampadang punya sampadang Sade deva anumodantu sabba sampati siddhya etavata chamhehi sampadang punya sampadang sabbe bhuta anumodantu sabba sampati siddhya etavata chamhehi sampadang punya sampadang sabbe satta anumodantu sabba sampati siddhya.